each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Hallin Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And it is my privilege to be sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. We are 1 month from Christmas, people, so start your engines or your shopping, or I'm not even going to go to the third rail of conversation about whether or not it's appropriate to put your Christmas decorations up before Christmas Eve. And some people feel very strongly about that. And so we're not going to discuss that today on the show. What we are going to discuss is something that might actually be more controversial than that. And that is the great question of when life begins. And I am so privileged and honored to be joined in studio today by Dr. Steve Jacobs. Steve holds a PhD from the University of Chicago and a Juris Doctor, which is a law degree, from Northwestern University here in Chicago. So two advanced degrees from two of the most distinguished universities in the United States. And Dr. Jacobs has done some extensive research on that very question of when human life begins, that question that stumped the Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade. And Dr. Jacobs, thank you so much for joining me today.
I appreciate you having me on.
Well, what a privilege to be with you. I was following you sort of virtually in cyber world and some of the controversy surrounding your research, and was just so grateful to be able to make this personal connection with you and have you in to really have an in-depth conversation. That's what I love about this show, is that, you know, we don't have to dissolve everything into a 15-minute soundbite or shorter conversation. We can really get into depth about some of the more pressing issues of the day. So let's kind of start back a little bit further, though. So you're a Chicago native, correct?
I am.
Okay. And then you did your undergraduate degree where?
So I actually started off at Oakton Community College.
Good for you.
I was one of the first from my family to go to college.
Really?
So I went to a place where it would be very cost effective. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to study as of yet. So I started at Oakton.
You know, I love to hear stories like that. And I think our mutual friend, Dan Proft, who's down the dial from us at AM 560, he always says it's not where you do college, it's how you do college. And don't get, I have another friend, Professor George Weigel, who says this too, don't get taken in by these big names, you know, especially for undergrad. So I'm so grateful to hear that. And it sounds like it worked out well for you.
It did.
Started at Oakton and...
Yeah, I ended up at Northeastern Illinois University. So I finished my undergrad there, and I had this great mentor, Brecky Church. She had gone to the University of Chicago herself for her PhD, so she kind of opened my eyes to the possibility of going to grad school.
Okay.
So I started University of Chicago's PhD program in 2009.
So you did that first? You did your PhD first?
So I actually did my law degree while I was in grad school.
And you slept when? When did that?
Yeah,
I barely
much.
Survived law school. I was only getting one degree.
Yeah.
How did you do that? That's, like, remarkable.
Well, it was actually out of necessity, right?
Uh-huh.
So basically halfway through my PhD program in 2014, this was when I was really trying to start my abortion research in earnest.
Okay.
So I had been shut down every attempt I had made up until that point. Professors told me it was too controversial, that I should do other research. And anybody I talked to amongst my peers or other professors, they made it seem like this wasn't a worthwhile subject to study, because obviously I wasn't coming at it from a certain ideological bent, mm-hmm. which they would have preferred. Okay. I wanted to look at the controversy itself. I wanted to take a step back and understand it from both perspectives.
Well, what made you interested in it? What made you interested in looking into sort of abortion policy and law and researching those particular things as they come together?
So it started in undergrad. I took a series of ethics classes, and I was really interested in how personhood shaped the law. That I noticed personhood as a concept was something that was ascribed to orangutans or robots or artificial intelligence,
right?
That we had all these interesting
corporations,
ideas.
Right? If you took corporation laws,
yeah,
we both had to suffer through, yeah, a corporation
right.
is a person.
So the difference
right.
between natural persons and legal persons, where
correct.
Legal persons, it's a fictitious concept where we essentially ascribe humanity to a non-human entity. So I just thought it was interesting that personhood was something that was seen as an expansive concept. It was something to include non-humans. Yet when it came to the abortion debate, we actually rejected the personhood of humans.
Hmm.
So I understood fetuses from a biological perspective to be humans, yet here they were being denied their personhood.
Okay.
So I wanted to understand why that move was made.
Huh. Okay. So you're working on your PhD, but you also wanted to get a better grasp of the legal concepts behind the issue of personhood. When you started your graduate work, were you involved? Let me even back up before then. When you were an undergrad, were you involved in the pro-life movement there? Was there a pro-life students club, or was it just something you had always sort of grown up with that particular belief?
So I actually grew up as a Christian. So that's part of the culture, part of the evangelical culture is
okay.
everybody's pro-life. I remember at a young age actually being in a grade school class where our teacher had us do this activity where we went to two sides of the room depending on what we thought about abortion.
Hmm.
And I remember being the only one on one side of the room
wow.
that was representing that position. And I don't know if it was the, let's say, the rebel in me that was just interested in defending the opposite position, but I ended up winning some people over to my side. So I did understand, you know, abortion, the way I saw it was the killing of a human. I knew it was a much more complex issue than just that. But I did have this sense from a young age that abortion was the way I saw it was I was really interested in why it seemed to be that there was so much rhetoric that seemed like it was almost scripted. So that was actually mm-hmm. one of my first angles to take on this research was why did it feel like there was almost these talking points that everybody said in exactly the same way? So tell me if you think you've ever heard this.
Okay.
I feel like I could actually hear the
my guess is yes, but you go ahead.
Right.
Try
so,
me.
I don't think I, as a man, have a right to tell a woman what to do with her body.
Okay.
And
I've heard
I swear
that one.
It's as if
yes.
it's the same words. It's the same. So I was interested in why, you know, when people compared fetuses to like parts of the body, I remember hearing it's like a toenail cell.
Right.
And it was always that same metaphor. It was never, you know, skin cells or liver cells. So I was interested in why.
Very dehumanizing language, right?
Very dehumanizing, yes. So I think I just had all of these different interests. And I remember when I went to the first professor back in 2010 to explain my interest in studying the debate, I said it was the very controversy that was what interested me most.
Okay.
So I had never been in pro-life debates. I still haven't even been to the March for Life. So
really?
Truly, no.
Oh, you've got to put that on your pro-life bucket list, my friend.
There
yeah,
you go.
There's no excuse for that. I'm sorry.
No, well, but especially as
we've
a researcher,
got to fix that. Yeah.
It was really important that I remain objective. I didn't have many contacts in the pro-life movement other than for the sake of my research. So
mm-hmm.
for me.
So your parents weren't like
no.
involved in like different groups or something like that. You just were like personally pro-life at home and in your worship, in your community, your faith community.
That's
was
right.
It was okay.
Yeah, and that's why part of the reason I went to law school was so I could figure out how to study the debate, and it was actually there that I became a mediator.
Mm.
So I trained in mediation. I became a certified mediator.
Whoa.
I actually used to mediate disputes in small claims courts.
Oh.
So we'll say like between landlords and tenants
right.
over small lawsuits. So it was my approach that, I would sit down with them and I'd tell them, either you're going to take a chance and possibly get nothing that you want,
right.
or you can work with us and get a resolution where you can at least get something that you want.
Right.
And that's kind of the approach I took to the abortion debate. I saw, you know, both sides pushing further to the edges. And at least in my scholarship, my biggest focus was on how do we mediate the interests between both sides.
Hmm. Okay. So you then you took those skills, those mediation skills, which I think that's a marvelous thing, especially if you, and I hope you do, look at this particular perspective, because I think you will be very helpful to the pro-life movement in that regard. That's a great debate skill to have, mediation, right? And at least if you're working with a hostile audience, I used to do a lot of college debates and always against the same woman from NARAL. And, you know, I felt that if I tried to be the more reasonable person, if I presented myself as approachable and reasonable and said, you know, even if you can't meet me where I am, you know, at 100%, you can probably meet me at halfway, right? I mean, right. You can say that, you know, elective abortions after 23 weeks are just not morally justified. And you'd see a lot of the college students nodding their heads. And this is when then the other side goes off the rails, right?
Sure.
And they say, no, it is. You cannot restrict someone's fundamental right, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what I'd like to talk about first from your law degree side of it is abortion, is the Supreme Court's designation as abortion as a fundamental right? So along like with your right to vote and your right to, you know, practice your religion and your right to, let's see, what are the other fundamental rights? I'm drawing a blank here. But, you know, like, so that's as big as it gets in constitutional law, right? So your right to marry who you want to marry, et cetera, et cetera. So tell me how the Supreme Court got to elevate and enshrine abortion as a fundamental right, because that makes it very difficult to try. And it's always the thing, at least when I did debates, my opponents would bring up, because they would say, you can't limit a fundamental right. So if you're going to say we're not going to do abortions after 20 weeks or 23 weeks, that's limiting a fundamental right, which is not constitutionally possible. So speak to me, just so our listeners, probably most of them aren't lawyers and aren't like, you know, abortion law geeks like the two of us would be. Can you kind of make that information a little more approachable for them?
Yeah. So, which is kind of my usual habit. I don't really go in the normal path that everybody does. So
right.
I understand that part of the rhetoric is, oh, if it's a fundamental right, it's so hard to overcome.
It's sacrosanct, right?
Yeah, this is something we're talking about in the pro-life movement right now is in with regards to the Reproductive Health Act, finding that abortion is a fundamental right. But it's actually not that scary. So it being a fundamental right, that doesn't mean that it can't be limited.
Mm-hmm.
All of our fundamental rights can still be limited mm-hmm. if there is a compelling state interest that requires it to be limited.
Okay,
so the whole reason why they framed it as a fundamental right was to make it more difficult to limit that right.
Okay.
So the first level is the rational basis test. So these are different judicial standards on which the court will assess a law. So the first level is rational basis test. And all this means is a state just needs to have some kind of rational purpose for passing the law.
Okay.
It's the lowest standard. It's really easy for a law to be found constitutional by the Supreme Court. The strictest test is called the strict scrutiny test.
Okay.
And that's what Roe was under. And this meant that it's a fundamental right. Therefore, a state must have a compelling state interest in order to overcome it. Now, one thing most people don't talk about is Roe did find a compelling state interest. It just found it at viability.
Right.
So even to those who say, oh, it's a fundamental right and there's no reason under which one can restrict that right, it's simply not true.
Right.
The Supreme Court already found that after viability, it can be restricted.
Right.
And this is because in
Roe
v. Wade—
That the state does have an interest in unborn human life once viability has been—
Yeah, so they found
reached.
Viability as the compelling point.
Okay.
The point at which the interest becomes compelling. So they had the court in Roe had actually considered whether or not it should be an absolute right. And they found that abortion shouldn't be, because that was what Roe was arguing for. The attorney for Roe, she was saying that this should be an absolute right, and the court rejected that.
Mm-hmm.
So it is already the case that even though it's found to be a fundamental right, technically, it could be restricted at fertilization. Abortion could be illegal throughout pregnancy
mm-hmm.
if the state interest is found to be compelling at fertilization.
Okay. And that's why you wanted to focus your research at the University of Chicago and the way you did to focus on that, I guess, kind of thorny question of when is it that human life that is human begins? What is that moment? So let's talk a little bit about this research that you did. And if you could, so your PhD is in comparative human development, which is probably a major that most people wouldn't know what that meant offhand. So if you could describe that and why you wanted to focus your research at University of Chicago through the lens of comparative human development.
Right. So this is an interdisciplinary program that draws on psychology, law, education, anthropology, sociology. So it's basically a catch-all group where people try to tackle big questions. And the only way you could tackle big questions is with multiple perspectives. So for me, I mean, one could argue I was a mediator, I was a lawyer, I was a psychologist, I was an anthropologist. Mm-hmm. I drew on all of these different disciplines to figure out what is an overarching answer to the abortion debate? What is going on? Why is it so contentious? How do we move forward?
Right.
When Life Begins became clear based on my legal review. Uh-huh. So basically, there have been three eras of abortion laws in this country. The first era was called the common law era. This came out of the English tradition. And here, abortion was illegal after quickening. Mm-hmm. That means when the fetus first stirred in the womb. And this was because this was the first evidence that they had that a woman was actually carrying a living child.
Okay.
So then it moved to, in the 1860s, Horatio Storer from the American Medical Association, all of these doctors in the 19th century, after it was found that a human's life begins at fertilization, they pushed for criminalization of abortion throughout pregnancy, throughout the country. So most people don't know, abortion was illegal for over a century mm-hmm. in all states
right.
other than for the life of the mother.
Right.
And the reason they used the life of the mother was this was a point at which it was two rights to life that were competing against each other.
Right.
And they favored, you know, the woman
the
in
mother's
that case.
Right, yes.
So then when Roe v. Wade took up this case, they had said that we do not know when a human's life begins.
Right.
They actually said we cannot resolve the difficult question of when life begins.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that they couldn't do it because there was no consensus of experts and that they were in no position to resolve the question,
right.
To speculate as to the answer. So they had pondered whether it should be scientists, if it should be doctors, if it should be religious leaders. They didn't even know from which perspective the question should be answered.
Okay.
Now, they ended up settling on viability based on their own analysis of this is a point at which it could survive outside the womb, so that seems compelling.
Right.
But basically, our laws have always been dictated by when life begins.
Yeah.
It doesn't it's just that they've shifted based on when we've defined that point.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, this is a perfect point to take a break, Steve. We're
okay.
going to go to our first break. And when we come back, I don't want to spend, you know, too much time on the history of Roe, but I do want to find out how it informed your decision to go after this question, which you've laid this out very nicely. So listeners, please don't go away. We're in for a fascinating hour today with Dr. Steve Jacobs, who so graciously joined us in studio today. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
At St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, we pray the Roman Canon in Latin on the first Sunday of each month. As Pastor Father Anthony Bush has written,
Latin in the Mass binds us ever more deeply to the saints of old and the Church's enduring character. In our time, when so much of what characterizes our identity of Catholics has been undone, it seems a spiritual and moral work of mercy to offer this simple gesture as a reminder that we are servants of a sacred story always under threat until Jesus comes at the end of all things.
The Roman Canon at St. Stanislaus Kostka Church on the first Sunday of each month. St. Stan's is handicapped accessible. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. For complete information, go to ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
And welcome back. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., along with the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And it is my privilege this hour to be sitting down with Dr. Steve Jacobs, who holds a Ph.D. from the University of Chicago and a Juris Doctor degree from Northwestern University, so a very smart man. And we are talking about his doctoral dissertation from the University of Chicago, which was a multidisciplinary dissertation that took into account the legal issues surrounding the Roe versus Wade decision, but also really went after that biological question that the Supreme Court really starts Roe out with, its written decision in Roe, talking about when human life begins. So, Steve, I know I have read articles either by you or about you in the Daily Wire had something this week, and Quillette, which I find to be one of the better websites for really good, fair, balanced intellectual conversations about the issues of the day, and your article in Quillette from October 16th. And listeners, I posted that on my Twitter feed as well as my Facebook page. So please, if you're listening and you want to go back and read that, please do. But you know, surprisingly, it seems to me that you did a very basic research project and got back results that weren't surprising to you and wouldn't be surprising to anybody who knows neonatologists or who, you know, regularly reads biology textbook, but they seemed to be quite upsetting to some of your academic peers at the University of Chicago. And so this did not go as smoothly as you had hoped, I guess, to put it mildly. Can you talk a little bit about what happened?
Sure. And to be fair, I did somewhat anticipate this.
I have been told
by people that I'm shooting down any chance I have of an academic career. A career in legal academia.
So you'll never teach.
Basically told. I was given fair warning. I don't know if I predicted that I'd have quite the response that I did.
Mm-hmm.
But basically what happened was people were so threatened by the possible implications of the research that they reached out to my school, made threats that they would—
Actual threats.
Well, so my study was shut down 5 different times. I think that's revealing in and of itself.
Now, for people who don't move in that world of higher education,
sure.
How does someone's study get shut down?
Right. So I had gone through the process of applying for approval by our institutional review board. They're our ethics committee. So they reviewed all of my materials, and they said that this was an ethical study that could move forward. Within a matter of days, I had people reaching out to the ethics committee demanding that my study be shut down, people reaching out to professors in my department demanding that I be kicked out of the department, that I not receive my degree. I had people emailing me directly and talking about how one person called me a fetus worshiper who was going to bring about the end of the world due to overpopulation. Let's just say it wasn't always the most fair or even-handed critiques.
And this is all because, just so I understand this is all because you were surveying biologists about their opinions on when human life began.
That's right. And I surveyed biologists because Americans selected them.
Okay.
So as I was talking about with Roe, they had contemplated all these different experts, possible experts on the question of when life begins. I surveyed 4,000 Americans, and I presented them with the options of biologists, philosophers, religious leaders, Supreme Court justices, and voters.
Mm-hmm.
So I presented them with 5 possible groups,
and
80% selected biologists.
Who was that pool of people?
So the Americans were from Amazon's Mechanical Turk service.
Okay.
So Amazon has this website where you could basically pay people to do surveys.
This is a well-used
methodology in the social sciences.
Okay.
It's a very representative sample. There's a lot of studies showing how representative it is of Americans.
Okay.
So this was a largely pro-choice sample. And pro-choice people were actually more likely to select biologists than even pro-life people.
Oh, I would think so. Right.
Because pro-life people would say religious leaders,
right.
You know, some
right.
of them. So over 80% selected biologists, and they selected them because they saw them as objective experts on a scientific question.
Okay.
So for me, it was just clear as day. And sure enough, the biologists themselves, they also selected themselves.
Okay.
So I asked biologists, who do you think is most qualified? And they said that they indeed were.
How long did that particular piece of the process work, surveying all these people through Turk, about who would you want to see weigh in definitively on When Life Begins?
So your question was, who did they select? Or?
No. So I know they selected the biologists,
yeah.
But how long did it take you to survey all these people, to compile, you know, the answers and to come up with the conclusion? Is that a lengthy part of the research?
No, it's fairly quick. I mean, I could practically design a survey, get it approved in a matter of weeks, and then analyze the data same day.
Okay.
So I had done multiple studies showing that they selected biologists. So that was when I actually started turning to the biologists.
Okay.
So I had emailed 70,000 biologists throughout the world. I found contact information on the website's faculty pages for over 1,500 universities. And, you know, some of the websites I'd have to translate. If they were in Chinese, I'd have to translate them
wow.
to English just
wow.
to be able to contact these professors. So my overall sample, it had professors from over 86 countries. It was truly an international study because I didn't want a biased perspective from just one country or from just one
tradition.
Just
from the Western world
yeah,
or from,
that's,
right.
That's precisely right.
Yes.
And I didn't find significant differences between the countries. So
okay.
Experts from every country had said that a human's life begins at fertilization. That final statistic, it was 96% had affirmed at least one view. You know how statistics goes. There's
right.
a bunch of different ways you can assess it. Another way, you know, if you look at the six questions I presented them with, 97% had affirmed all six compared to only 3% had rejected all six.
Wow.
So it depends on how you
analyze
it. So
you asked the question six different ways?
Yes.
Okay. And can you share, you know, give me an example of one of the ways in which you asked that question then?
From a biological perspective, when would you say a human's life begins? That was an essay question.
Okay.
So in developmental biology, fertilization marks the beginning of a human's life.
Okay.
So these were very straightforward questions. They were assessed with different geneticists and biologists, developmental biologists I spoke with. I looked at textbooks. I mean, I did all of my homework to make sure
right.
I was representing decent, fair views. You know, it's not – some people make it out to be like I was asking, you know, is an abortion murder?
Right.
Or I was using this loaded language. They were just strictly scientific questions that an ethics committee approved.
So, okay. So that was going to be my next question. Did you need to submit these six questions to a professor, someone overseeing your dissertation work in advance?
I did,
and
yes.
you did. So, and it wasn't just one person; it was an entire ethics committee.
That's right.
And who was what was that ethics committee composed of in terms of people's specific areas of expertise?
Well, so I don't know what the breakdown of the ethics committee was. My dissertation committee, that was a four-person committee. I had a biologist, a historian, I had an anthropologist, and then I had a law professor.
Okay.
And they were all pro-choice. And it was something
wow.
they often reminded me of in our meetings.
Wow.
So for me, I feel like...
Did you change any of their minds, do you think, at the end of the day? Any of them rethinking their positions on abortion?
We didn't really have those kinds of conversations, and it really wasn't what I set out to do. I'll be honest, I faced a lot of cognitive dissonance from them. So I remember even in my dissertation hearing, I had one ask the question, what's the difference between a fetus and a sperm? That isn't masturbation a form of mass murder? So, I mean, let's be honest. When you have been thinking about the abortion debate in one way for decades, it's very difficult to get out of that frame, especially the more intelligent or the more accomplished you are. It's harder for you to distance yourself mistaken beliefs.
I mean, that sounds to me, honestly, like if I'm giving a talk at a high school. That's like a junior boy high school question.
Low level,
good
right.
heaven. No, it is. It's a low-level question. And you think of University of Chicago and you just think of the geniuses and the intellectual, you know, all your Nobel Prizes. And I'm quite surprised that you would have a question.
And this person,
that ridiculous.
This
was
person
absurd.
Was probably one of the smartest people I've ever met, the most
really?
Impressive people I've ever met. I couldn't hold them in higher regards.
Right.
And I think for me, those moments, though, I don't see it as him being stupid or having the wrong opinion in that moment. I think that showed how profound cognitive dissonance, identity, protective cognition, motivated reasoning. These are all fun phrases for bias.
Right.
These are all the notion that once you're so committed to a belief, you'll do any amount of, you know, as they talk about it, mental gymnastics.
Correct.
In order to justify what your beliefs are.
Right.
And that there's no other way of understanding how he could say something like that.
How did you respond to him? What was your reply?
I think I was just baffled.
You just... Once you were able to close your mouth after it dropped to
Right. I mean, I explained it to him. Especially in the hearing, you know, some people made it out to be, how will pro-choice people respond to your article? Mm-hmm. How will these people respond to your dissertation? And then it was one professor who stepped up and said, we're not here to talk about what its societal impact will be. We're here to talk about his scholarly work. Talk about his dissertation.
Good.
Is it good science? Is it good argumentation?
Right.
And that's what we should focus
on. Is it well-researched?
I mean,
is it
before right. I went in my dissertation hearing, I was down the hall waiting for them as they, like, set up for the hearing.
Right.
And I heard them screaming. There was screaming coming from the room. I mean, and I'm walking into the most important meeting of my life, and I hear them yelling. So once somebody opened the door after the screaming, they said, you know, obviously it's a very contentious discussion, you know, about the abortion debate. I'm like, well, my research shouldn't be contentious.
Right.
It's one thing if you want to debate the merits of abortion.
The research was very straightforward.
It was very easy, yeah.
So do you get the sense, here's what my, you know, instinct would say, if they're screaming, there wasn't an issue with your research because it was good. The issue was for the people who support abortion— does this give the other side ammunition now that we can't shoot down? I mean, that's
right.
Always the,
and
you know.
Somebody from the ethics committee actually reached out to me one Friday morning, and they said, this seems like you're just collecting data for a legal campaign, that you're trying to change the minds of biologists, that this isn't real research.
Mm.
So this was a dean of our ethics committee.
Wow.
An hour later, she sent me an email saying that she rescinded her comments, that she shouldn't have made them. And, you know, wish me a good day. I mean, I think that was an interesting moment to see what kinds of experiences these academics, these administrators were having.
And, yeah, you know, it's surprising, and listeners, for those of you who aren't really familiar with the University of Chicago, it's considered behind Harvard and Yale the number three university in the country. It has the most Nobel Prize winners. It's particularly known for its programs in economics, but its law school has also produced a number of Supreme Court justices. Really is considered just top-notch academically. However, it's different from other universities these days because open dialogue and discourse are not only permitted on the campus, they are encouraged.
That's right.
And the president of the university sent out a letter, I believe it was 2 or 3 years ago, because I think there was a quasi-controversial person coming to speak on campus and, you know, essentially said, if you can't come and talk about ideas, you really don't belong here because we allow people to be heard.
That's right, talking
school.
About how there are no safe spaces on our campus.
Correct. That's exactly
and
the phrase he used. That's
what
right.
What was so interesting was this was happening at a time that my research was being stifled, at a time where I was experiencing, I mean, one of the biggest parts of my story is basically that I had an advisor who started supporting me in 2014. He helped me design the original survey for biologists. I had collected about 1,000 participants worth of data. The heat got too hot for him, and then he ended up saying that he would not support me continuing my research. He said that he would, if anything, recommend against me getting my dissertation if I continued, and then he basically abandoned me as his student. We were in a meeting with another member from my committee, and he was saying things like, you take him. If you want to support his research, you take him.
Wow.
And the other professor—
right in front of you?
Right in front of me.
Oh,
and the other
gosh.
Professor was so moved by it.
You must have a very thick skin. Go ahead. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you don't go into this kind of research with this perspective
Yikes.
Without being ready.
Right.
You know? So the other professor, he tried to help me find another advisor who would approve my research. So it was already approved, but he was rescinding his approval.
Right.
Which this is something I've spoke to some people and they said this never happens.
And so you were saying that there was someone else at the table hearing this.
Yes.
Who was upset by it or?
another committee member who was basically acting as mediator.
Okay.
Because he was saying that this only happens when somebody passes away, when somebody moves away.
Right.
Once a professor says that this is ethical research that should continue, it continues, right? The only reason it wouldn't is, you know, some kind of extraneous circumstance. But he said that he did not want anything with his name on it that's used by the pro-life movement.
And this is only because your research, again, I just want to be clear,
yeah.
Your research focused on the question of when human life begins, and the results were already coming back.
Yes.
Indicating that biologists worldwide were saying fertilization.
That there was a consensus, yes. So he knew that it was about 95% at the time. So I believe, you know, I really don't know what kind of pressure he was under. And what was perhaps most interesting is he had written that these ethics committees had been overstepping their bounds in trying to control students too much, that we should be able to ask whatever questions we want. He at one point said, Socrates is rolling around in his grave at the notion of how difficult it is for people to do research today. Yet he then told me that his ethical standards are higher than the ethics committee. So he's out in public writing these articles saying that the ethics committee's standards are too high. And then he said his are even higher. And he said, mine do not meet that burden because according to him, essentially, he didn't want mine to be politicized, my research to be used by the pro-life movement in any way. And it was only after that other professor who sat in on our meetings, he actually had me write a 5-page essay explaining everything that happened before he continued to support me. So he ended up stepping up as my advisor so I could finish my study.
You know what it's making me think of? And this was probably going back a good 15 years, but there was a paper that came out from two professors at the University of Chicago, and I'll try to find it during the break, where they essentially said, if abortion is made illegal, crime rates are going to increase significantly. Now, that was ethical, but you talking to biologists wasn't ethical.
Right.
Do you remember that particular study?
From Freakonomics.
Right.
It ended up being publicized in Freakonomics.
You
it's
talk about politicizing.
Debunked.
Yeah. And it has been debunked, of course. Yeah.
Right.
But they ran with that as if it was, you know, so abortion is going to save humanity because we're getting rid of all the criminals now.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a disgraceful piece of work.
Oh,
but
sure.
I just remember being so surprised University of Chicago allowed that to be publicized in the way that it was, again, in such a politically divisive way.
Mm-hmm.
So this surprises me that something on the other end of the spectrum, like your work, which seems to me to be very scientifically based, not making outrageous statements. You didn't make any statement. It was simply looking at like what biology textbooks say every day.
Right. And I do want to be fair in saying that at least I was able to complete my research. So the University of Chicago did not ultimately shut it down where I didn't get my degree. I want to be fair and say that there were certain representatives who stood up and defended the academic freedom tradition.
Okay.
And they defended my rights as an academic. It's just that I really should have had more support from the institution. And it's even, I mean, we're at the point where I haven't heard from anybody from the school since then.
Wow.
The local papers, so the Chicago Maroon, that's a student-run paper.
Right, that's their paper.
They had contacted me after my research came out over the summer. Their editor interviewed me for over an hour, said that the article was going to come out, and then the article never came out, and she actually never replied to any of my emails.
Wow.
So I had asked her, like, oh, hey, is the article going to come out? And this was after she said she was going to reach out to the professor to get his side of the story. So I don't know what happened, whether or not that study was shut down. But I mean, her article was shut down. I've emailed them a few times and I've never heard back from them.
Wow.
So, however, I will actually be going back to the school to talk to the College Republicans. So their group
Excellent.
Just invited me to talk
fantastic.
In January.
Fantastic.
And I'm
excited about that. Well, this is a great point for us to take our next break. And then when we come back, I would like you to address specifically some of the public attacks that are being made on your work, that you obtained your information unethically. That seems to be a trope that's out there now, and I would like you to take that head on, if you wouldn't mind. And so, listeners, please don't go away. We'll be back with Dr. Stephen Jacobs after the break. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Listener Supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, where you can enter into the presence of Christ 24/7. Every first Saturday afternoon will be a special opportunity for healing. At 4:30, bring your petitions for our Blessed Mother's intercession as we pray the Rosary. Then, at 5, we share the body of Christ in the Holy Mass. Also, at 5:30, a Spanish Mass, followed by a Eucharistic procession, adoration, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and an anointing. Enter into the sacred space of St. Stanislaus Kostka and place yourself before Christ for healing. On first Saturday afternoon, starting at 4:30, find St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, 2 blocks north of Division, on Noble, just off the Kennedy in Chicago, and find peace and healing.
The winds of change on AM 750 WNDZ.
I'm Father Thomas Loya, and I'm inviting you to Christmas on the Prairie. Come and hear the story of the real St. Nicholas and take a ride with him in his own horse-drawn carriage.
Saturday evening, December 7th, from 2 to 6 p.m., an indoor and outdoor family event. Experience the beauty of a Byzantine church, and homemade Christmas bake sale items are available. Christmas on the Prairie at Annunciation Byzantine Catholic Church, 14610 Wilcook Road, Homer Glen, Illinois, Saturday, December 7th from 2 to 6 p.m.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony on listener-supported Winds of Change. And I am joined this hour by Dr. Stephen Jacobs, PhD from the University of Chicago, Juris Doctor degree from Northwestern University, and an expert on the issue now of when human life begins, because he wrote his doctoral dissertation interviewing almost 6,000 biologists. And I don't even think we got to this statistic of the, I think it's 5,557, right, you spoke to or interviewed. Of them, how many said that life begins at fertilization?
So it's 96%.
96%. And that is astounding. And the other 4%, where did they put the line?
So they essentially didn't affirm any of the statements that I presented them with.
Okay.
So if you look to the essay question, most wrote about fertilization. So this was supposed to be an open-ended essay question where I didn't want them to assess the view that it begins at fertilization. I wanted them to feel free to talk about what their view was, right?
Okay.
And I found that, again, most spoke about fertilization, and then some people talked about implantation, and then a lot of pro-choice people talked about viability and birth.
Okay.
But neutral, so I had actually known what their beliefs on abortion were by asking them, are they pro-life, are they pro-choice, are they more moderate? So what I found was the moderates, they looked a lot like the pro-life people. So they answered pretty much in the same way. It was only the extremely pro-choice that deviated.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you talk about implantation being one of the touch points for some people. And, you know, you may or may not be aware that, you know, back in the 60s, the American Obstetrical Society actually changed the definition of pregnancy.
That's right.
From fertilization to implantation because of the birth control pill.
Yes.
And because the birth control pill often works after fertilization, mm-hmm. but before implantation. So when they readjusted the definition of pregnancy to mean implantation, or defined it as implantation in order to be able to, you know, prescribe birth control pills, because abortion was still illegal.
That's right.
And they would have been considered abortifacients.
Yeah, most people don't think about it that way. But,
yeah.
I mean, essentially, the birth control pill can thin the mucus lining of mm-hmm. the uterine wall and
prevent
implantation. Yeah.
Right. Right. And so, yeah, that's a very that's a point that some people don't know. And I know there is some dispute even among pro-life OBGYNs about whether or not the pill, you know, in its current form acts as an abortifacient. There are a lot who do, some who say it doesn't. But
yeah,
it's interesting to me that the very fact that the definition of pregnancy had to be changed.
That's right.
Says something. Now,
it
again,
does.
The makeup of the pill has changed from, you know, the levels of estrogen contained in the birth control pill have changed since those times. But anyway, that being said, Let's talk about these very ad hominem at time attacks against you. I think you and I got to know each other a little bit better when we were in defending each other on Twitter. We were talking about, I think the overall conversation revolved around comments that an abortion provider named Dr. Leah Torres had made. And I was trying to point out that the law recognizes the humanity of the unborn in a multitude of other situations.
Yes.
Fetal homicide laws, inheritance laws, property
right.
laws, tort law. You know, they're unborn babies for a lot of different reasons except for abortion, right? So
right.
I had cited your research in as one of my talking points. And then I got piled on by a whole bunch of people who said that your research had been proven to have been obtained deceptively and that it had been debunked and et cetera, et cetera. Mm. So can you respond? Because I know based on my speaking to you today, you're going to have a lot of people looking up your work. And I want you to be able to tell our listeners directly what those allegations are and how you respond to them.
Right. So as we know, it started before the data even came out. Just the very notion to these biologists who were supposed to be more neutral arbiters of science, they were so, let's say, incensed by, scared of my results that they were trying to stop me, that they
yeah.
were trying to stop my research. My own committee member who had supported me for years, and I had a great fondness for him. He had a great fondness for me. I've actually TA'd his class that he's been teaching for decades.
Hmm.
He said more times than anyone else before me.
Hmm.
And he even basically tried to end my academic career over me continuing this research. So let's just start with the notion that they have huge ideological and personal, usually financial reasons why they want to fight out against the notion that fetuses are humans and abortion
mm-hmm.
is a form of homicide.
Mm-hmm.
That is no easy thing for somebody who routinely defends abortion to have to face that reality.
Right.
And that was one of the biggest things from my research is talking about what's called identity protective cognition.
Mm-hmm.
And what this means is if you see a fact that conflicts with your worldview, that conflicts with your identity, you're actually going to side with the information that supports your identity rather than that which attacks it.
Okay.
And this is a lot of evolutionary psychologists. They actually argue that we have developed to agree with the herd more than recognize truth or recognize reality.
Right.
Because the consequences of going against the group are so great.
Right.
So here we have people who, let's just say it's a big part of their worldview that abortion is a good.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very difficult for them to recognize it simultaneously as a form of homicide.
Right.
And this was actually even discussed. I recently posted this article from a medical journal in California in 1970 where a pro-choice physician was talking about how they needed to disconnect the reality of when life begins from abortion.
From abortion,
because
right.
it makes it too difficult for people to defend it.
Because
right. we see homicide as
right.
a great evil.
Yep.
So how is it that they could defend abortion as a form of homicide?
Right.
So it's just easier to reject
well,
it.
Well, now, do you use the word homicide? When I'm doing debates and stuff, I tend to stay away from homicide because it's such a specific legal term. I just say it's killing.
Yeah, I think that's
fine. Because then they'll say, well, it's not homicide because it's legal. And then you get in, you know, you
yeah.
get off into that little group of weeds there. So I tend to just, you know, to use the word killing. It is killing because,
right.
you know, it's legal killing currently. But in many other contexts, it would be homicide. For example, fetal homicide laws.
Sure. So homicide isn't necessarily illegal.
Yeah.
So there are justifiable forms of homicide.
Correct.
If
right.
one kills somebody in self-defense, that's still a homicide. One of the reasons I don't necessarily just use killing is that one can kill a dog.
Mm-hmm.
One can kill a whale.
Right.
Killing a dog is never a homicide.
Right.
Homicide embeds the notion that you are killing a human.
Ah.
And I think that's part of the reason why I'm inclined to use homicide.
Right.
I never use murder because
right.
murder is obviously a legal concept that
right.
requires that it be illegal.
Right. Well, so I guess that homicide being, you know, that. You break down the Latin, the Homo sapiens killing of a human, correct? So it's
right.
it's a way of doing that as opposed to, you know, I don't know what you would call the killing of a dog. I'm trying to think back.
Canicide.
Go back, canicide. There you go. Yeah.
But it's not to say that I think one is the best word to use. Obviously, it's a semantic minefield. And
right.
my using homicide, it does provoke reactions that aren't preferable sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that I think it really positions the discussion within that scientific reality.
Yeah.
So if they want to deny its humanity, I put them in a position where they can do that.
Right.
That we can actually hash out what it is.
Well, you know, we talked about this a little bit at the beginning. You know, the logistics, the logical hoops and the linguistic twisting that people on the other side have to do. I mean, you know, I just think that must be a very difficult place to be in. Now, I have on occasion debated people who have said, listen, you know, it is life that's, I mean, somebody from, who was it? I think it was Kitty Colbert, who she's the one who argued the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision for, and I debated her at Princeton, and she, and she just straight up said, but you know what? It's the life that is not as important as the life of the mother. So the mother gets to decide that being, whatever you want to call it, has no rights until the moment it's born. She straight up said it. And I said to her, I thanked her. I said, you know, at least you're honest. You're not trying to play games with me. She said, I just don't believe it has any rights.
Right.
End of story. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because you're seeing the pro-abortion movement kind of, they're getting away from that kind of direct honesty, I think, because people are so uncomfortable with it.
That's right.
Yeah, Nayral tweeted out something bizarre this morning. I think it must have been in response to the last Democratic debate where they said abortion is a winning issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't know how any group fairly could make that statement, because Americans are profoundly conflicted over abortion.
That's right.
Profoundly.
And most actually only support abortion access in the first trimester.
Right.
They roundly reject the notion that it should be available in the third trimester, in the second trimester.
Right.
So when you see all of the leading Democratic candidates in the upcoming election push the notion that it should be an absolute right for any reason at any time.
Right.
I mean, my research suggests at most 15% of the country supports this.
Oh, at most. I think it's far less than that.
But so how is that a winning issue to do something where 85% of Americans oppose it?
Right.
And
right.
they rely on those semantic ambiguities. They rely on the tricks of the language where you see some polls where they'll say, you know, do you support Roe?
Without knowing what Roe means all 9 months for any reason.
And there's research that suggests that people don't actually know what Roe stands for.
Oh, my goodness. Even people who work in some of those organizations have never actually sat down and read the entire case, and they certainly haven't read Doe versus Bolton, which is its companion case, which is what extends abortion, you know, for the all 9 months. Well, we're going to go to our last very quick break. Please don't go away. This hour has flown by today, but please stay with us until the end. We're going to wrap up our conversation with Dr. Steve Jacobs. This is Mary Fiorito. I am sitting in today for Father Anthony on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
This week, we gather round the table with family and friends and offer our thanks to God for the gift of our very life and the blessings bestowed upon us. Happy Thanksgiving from Winds of Change.
There is a lot going on at St. Stan's. St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. There is Eucharistic adoration before the iconic monstrance, confessions 4 days per week, and masses in English, Polish, and Spanish. There's much more waiting for you here. St. Stan's is right off the Kennedy Expressway, just 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Find out more by going to ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org, and enter into the presence of Christ.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
I'm Father Thomas Loya, inviting you to join the 2020 Theology of the Body Institute on the ultimate pilgrimage, walking and praying in the footsteps of Jesus. Join myself,
Christopher West,
Father Justin Brady,
Jason Clark,
and the TOB team as we visit Jerusalem, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Via Della Rosa, Bethlehem, and more.
The 2020 TOB Institute's Holy Lands Pilgrimage, Saturday, February 15th through Tuesday, February 25th, 2020, with an optional extension to Jordan, February 25th through the 27th. While you're on the 2020 TOB Pilgrimage, you'll have first-class hotel accommodations, air-conditioned tour buses, breakfast and daily dinner, plus special meals, daily formation with Christopher West and chaplains. For complete information and registration for the 2020 TOB Institute's Holy Lands Pilgrimage, visit tobpilgrimages.com. That's tobpilgrimages.com. Or call 1-800-842-4842. Reserve now.
And welcome back. This hour has just flown by. This is Mary Fiorito sitting down for a conversation today with Dr. Steve Jacobs, PhD from the University of Chicago, JD from Northwestern University. And at the outset of our conversation, Steve, you mentioned that your initial training as a professional was in mediation. And so that gives you, I think, boy, a terrific way to approach the abortion issue. So let's, you know, Thanksgiving's coming up, and I know everyone's going to be sitting around the table talking about abortion at the Thanksgiving table, if they're not talking about the impeachment hearings. Let's bring up abortion just to keep things lively. Let's talk about the best arguments on either side. Maybe starting with the pro-choice arguments, because I think our pro-life friends obviously know how to respond to some things. But tell us, what are the arguments you find most persuasive, and how do you answer them?
Right. So in any mediation, there's really a common set of facts that both sides have to agree to. And that's part of the reason why I actually asked Americans who should answer the question of when life begins. I asked them, do you think when life begins is an important question?
Right.
I found that 93% of all Americans said that a human's life is protectable once it begins.
Okay.
So for me, it's clear that both sides agree that, you know, when life begins is an important question.
Right.
So the common facts really are that a fetus is a human. From
right.
the moment of fertilization, it is a human from a biological perspective.
Right.
So for the strongest pro-choice argument, the tactic is called steel manning. So if you've ever heard of straw manning, that's when you present a weak argument of the other side.
Okay.
Steel manning is the exact opposite. This is where you present the strongest possible argument from the other side. So if you're creating the strongest pro-choice argument, it would be one that recognizes the humanity of fetuses.
Right, like Kitty Colbert did with me.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, you. Not only do you respect it, her credibility goes up in your eyes.
Right.
So if you're going to be the strongest pro-choice person, you have to recognize the humanity of fetuses as well as their personhood.
Okay.
Because if you look at all of these holdings and arguments from the Supreme Court, if you're a human, you are a person.
Okay.
So the strongest argument would be that abortion is a form of homicide. But it is justifiable as a form of self-defense.
Okay.
So the argument would be that women face a certain risk of mortality in carrying a pregnancy to term and by giving birth. So that woman has a right to defend herself against the threat represented by the fetus.
Okay. So you think that's the strongest argument?
I think, yeah.
And you think, so really, I mean, of course, your wonderful research notwithstanding, you don't think it's the when the life begins. Is not the strongest.
Well, so the reason I say that self-defense is the strongest argument is because it entails the argument that a fetus is a human.
Okay.
The reason why you could use self-defense to justify abortion is the same reason that you and I are humans and we're persons under the law.
Right.
But if we pose a certain type of threat, we can be killed with impunity.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying a 1 in 5,000 chance of dying in childbirth is necessarily enough to trigger self-defense as a
And then, of course, virtually every state, even the most strict abortion laws, involve a life of the mother exception.
Right.
And when you speak to, like, if you look at the Dublin Declaration, you signed by thousands of OBGYNs and neonatal intensive care doctors and nurses who say, we can't find a reason that you would need to, medically speaking, to perform a direct abortion to save a mother's life.
Right.
And, you know, the Dr. Tony Levitino, who I happen to know, hold him in great admiration. Mm. He worked for many years as a maternal fetal medicine doctor.
Yeah.
And so treating the sickest moms, carrying the sickest babies. And he said the number of times I had to do an abortion to save one of my patients' lives was zero.
Mm-hmm.
Never happened in the 12 years I did this kind of work. And he said, and in fact, had I done an abortion on some of my patients, for example, we talked about preeclampsia at the outset.
Sure.
Someone comes in with preeclampsia. Her blood pressure is 200 over 120 or something outrageous like that. He said, I have to stabilize her and I have to remove that baby now. I don't have 3 days to insert laminaria to make sure that we can deliver, you know, the dead unborn child. She'd be dead by then, too.
Mm.
So, well, Dr. Steve Jacobs, where can people follow you on social media?
At Dr. Steve Jacobs on Twitter.
Okay.
And then there's been a bunch of articles written about me. If you Google Dr. Steve Jacobs, you can read anything and feel free to contact me. My contact information is on my
Twitter
page.
Terrific. Well, thank you. What a gift.
Thank you for having me.
I say my Thanksgiving prayers. I'll be thanking God for you and for your good work. This has been Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Listener Supported Winds of Change. God bless you and have a very happy Thanksgiving.
Do we search deep for truth or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is wrought. It's time to be stirred. The time.